Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 147, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
And normally this time of year, like start of November, it kind of feels a bit like the quiet before the storm, doesn't it? Do you remember being a kid and like you just couldn't wait for Christmas to get started?
Bloody Christmas adverts already on TV. I'm just like, God, it was Halloween.
Like yesterday, yeah. It's going to come around so quickly.
That's it.
But I mean, what I do like about this time of year is I've been moving house recently. My man cave is all set up. I know you've been working on yours as well.
Yeah.
I've been spending so much time indoors playing games recently, which is like a novelty. You couldn't do that over summer. It was too warm.
Yeah, my VR was so hot. Like literally, I'd do 2 minutes on that. Now I can do about half an hour and then I'm like, get this thing off my head. But another thing is kind of unwanted gifts. And you know, you have Raspberry Pis.
Oh, I've got them coming out my ears, Raspberry Pis.
Yeah, well, we may have a little use for them today, which combines an old school piece of technology with our guest.
Now, also, I mean, you mentioned about gifts and stuff there too. It is the time of year when people are starting to think about what they might want in the Christmas stockings. And I'm sure there's going to be so many products that are coming out over the next few weeks or few months that are all vying for our Christmas spending money. So we've got a few ideas and things that you might want to see in your Christmas stocking, and that one this week that you probably definitely will not. So we'll talk more about that in just a bit. Now, we are going to be covering something we haven't really talked about on this podcast a lot, yet it is something that we've got so much nostalgia for. And that is teletext.
Yeah, we've had Mr. Biffo talking about Digitizer, which was a kind of video games magazine.
Yeah.
Daily video games magazine, actually, which is crazy. But the legacy of teletext, especially in the UK, is huge. Like, we have teletext holidays,
yeah,
which are still going, even though the service like got shut down in 2012.
It's a website now, isn't it?
Yeah, but they're still one of the big holiday agencies going. And there's loads of stuff. Digitizer's just got a show.
Yeah. Absolutely. I remember being on teletext holidays, you know, with my dad, trying to look at holidays, and there'd be like, was it like 1,000 pages or something stupid? And then he'd be like, oh, where's the hold button when you arrive down? Oh, you missed it. You've got to wait 20 minutes now for it to come back.
Go all the way around.
And then it's gone by the time it comes back. But I mean, we've all got memories of being there as kids. I remember stuff like Bamboozle, you know, like the kids' quiz. It was on Channel 4. Digitizer, used to read that gaming magazine religiously on there, sitting there on my, like, you know, Superman PJs. Cross-legged in front of the telly, like with a little
just even
control.
Getting jokes. I'm sure they used to have like a rubbish joke that you could look at every day and be like, little chuckle, you know, dad joke, wasn't it?
Yeah, but that, I mean, in that pre-internet age, it was really the only way that you could get that kind of instant on-demand information.
Yeah, and now it's kind of shut down. There's a community called TFAX, and they've actually started a new service that you can get on your Raspberry Pis, which is amazingly exciting. And our guest is the teletext archaeologist.
Now, Jason Robertson is going to be joining us this week. This, I mean, when you mentioned that we've got him on, I was like, oh, yeah, you know, a lot of the stuff we were talking about before we did the interview, it really started to come back to me, and it was kind of, a lot of it was forgotten. Of course, we talk about games and that all the time and computers and stuff, but I was like, oh, God, I remember that. This week's interview is so nostalgic. You're going to hear stuff that you probably haven't thought about for like 20, 30 years.
Totally, and the stuff that Jason does is amazing. He basically extracts teletext from video, but like he does Betamax as well, even videos from the 70s, and I just don't know how he does it. We're going to find out in this interview, but that's astonishing, isn't it, that you can kind of get old news, weird 4-bit information from a videotape.
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of us have probably got boxes of VHS tapes in the attic that we think, or you might have an old recording of Jurassic Park on there off telly when it was first broadcast, but there is more on those tapes than you realise, because teletext went over the air. And it was kind of encoded in these video pictures. And we'll find out a bit more about how it worked. But essentially, you can get these old tapes that you recorded, like back in the 80s and 90s, and you can still get the teletext pages off them.
It's crazy. Yeah. And then if you have a Raspberry Pi, you can view it on there using John's kind of archive.
And you were telling me about, you know, when you first saw this new teletext service running, and you saw, like, BBC News updated and all that again?
Yeah, so I was kind of... I was like walking past, I think it was a retro computer museum. Yeah. I walked past and I saw BBC News on teletext. I thought, oh, that's an old one. And then I looked at the headlines and I was like, wait, that's today's news. How have they done that? And it turns out they can get feeds from the BBC as well and actually still have a daily news service on there. It's mad.
So we're going to find out all about that, you know, archiving the classic teletext pages, how you can look at them again, and also how you can access teletext in 2018 using stuff like the Raspberry Pi on your modern TV. So it is one for the geeks this week, but it's so interesting. Jason Robertson, the teletext archaeologist, is coming up on the Retro Hour podcast in around 15 minutes from now. I love it when we get really geeky.
Yeah, yeah, it's good.
Now, before we get into this week's news stories, we do appreciate it is a very expensive time of year coming up. You know, everyone wishes there was another payday tagged on between the next two. But, I mean, we have got all our renewal costs coming up with it being the third anniversary of the podcast very soon. And if you'd like to help support the Retro Hour and help keep this show going into 2019, then all you have to do is nip onto our website. We do have a little PayPal button on there, cryptocurrency if you're into that too. And, of course, any donations that we get into the running of the show massively help. We've got all our renewal costs coming up in January, so it'll be very well timed if you can just, you know, spare the price of a coffee or something like that. You can find it right now at theretrohour.com. Our little tip jar is on the front page, and for doing that you will get a mention on a future episode in the Retro Hour Hall of Fame, just like this week. And I do apologise before I say this because I'm going to completely butcher it, I'm sure, but thank you Yane Huane Haino,
our mate Darren Coles,
Ian Fleming
and Mark Sorantz,
who all made donations into the running of the show. And you can do the same at theretrohour.com, and that will be hugely appreciated. I did mention I've been moving house recently. One of the things I found that I hadn't seen for a while, a little bag containing my old Game Boy Pocket I found in there with a few games.
I actually Play Blackpool bought this awesome customised Game Boy Advance, and it had like a backlit screen on it and everything, and it was all replaced, and got that for my fiance's birthday, and she was well happy.
It looked gorgeous, that screen. So I'd forgotten how bad the screen was on the original Game Boy. Trying to play mine the other day, and I was like, what? That said, the screen on it was better quality than the camera back in the day. Do you remember the Game Boy camera?
Yes, well, the Game Boy camera has kind of taken an interesting twist, and I'm surprised nobody's done this before, actually. But what's happened is an amateur photographer called Matthew Paris has basically hooked up his £200 Olympus camera to the sensor. So what he's done is he's taken his camera sensor out, I assume, and he's using the Game Boy sensor on it. And this has really helped with the exposure and the quality of shots. So we've got an article that we're going to link in the show notes. If you look at it, it's a monstrous contraption. It's kind of a... what, elastic band and electric tape is holding it together?
Well, it's a Game Boy Color with a DSLR, yeah, taped to the top of it, essentially, isn't it?
Totally. But if you look in the article at the bottom, he has a without modified picture on the Game Boy Advance, which is of a girl on it. And then up at the top, he's got the new versions that have been taken, and they look fantastic. Like, I remember you used to get tiny, tiny, tiny little dots on the Game Boy Advance camera. This one's kind of more blocky, and the shading looks correct and everything. But it does cost £200, doesn't it?
I mean, it's not bad for a DSLR, £200, actually. And I imagine you could probably do it with any DSLR camera. And he's essentially putting the Game Boy camera through a 50mm lens. So obviously the original had that tiny little plastic lens on there, didn't it?
Yeah.
So I mean, it does make sense that it's going to look a lot nicer, but... yeah, the resolution of those is actually really good.
Yeah, yeah. No, it looks like it's got a really nice aesthetic. And when you kind of looked at the Game Boy stuff when it was, especially when it was printed out afterwards, you'd hardly be able to see anything, would you?
I had a Game Boy printer as well, actually. I need to get that up and running. But yeah, my selfies that I took on that back in the day, I wouldn't want to see them in that high resolution, if I'm honest.
That's a pretty cool hack. But imagine if, like, you know, you had a paparazzi, you got a telescopic lens and everything, and, you know, took it to the next level.
I'm sure someone will do that. Yeah. It's only a matter of time. So everyone check that out. We'll put that and the rest of this week's stories, of course, in the show notes, like we do every week at theretrohour.com. And I found this article that I thought kind of resonated a bit with me. Some of it I don't agree with, but I thought this might be a bit of a giggle to talk about. A website called Mandatory have done what they say are the top 10 retro gaming annoyances that they are glad are now stuck in the past.
Okay, let's hear some.
Now, number one, I think we can all agree with, checkpoint codes in games.
Yeah, yeah, that is very frustrating. Why? Like, you know, we've been playing some Game Boy Advance games, and I think there's a function to actually save on them, but quite a lot of them are game codes as well that you have to put in.
Well, that was, you know, before the days of like save states and...
yeah, you end up having a little notebook, don't you, at the side, and then you lose all your codes and you have to start again.
And even then, it wouldn't often put you right back where you were in the game. It'd be like the nearest, you know, checkpoint, essentially, wouldn't it? They were awful. But I remember a lot of the time you'd wait till a magazine came out and would print them all out, wouldn't you, to get to the next level of the game. So I don't miss those. You know, the talking either make an example. Echo the Dolphin for the Mega Drive was a notoriously difficult game that most kids never even came close to beating. Not even checkpoint codes were enough to make that a reasonable challenge. The next one, I'm a bit divided on this one. They're talking about small TVs. Now, they're saying that, you know, not only were CRTs pretty heavy back in the day and took up a lot of room, but they say these days we kind of take it, you know, for granted that you can sit there in front of, like, your 65-inch LCD screen. But they're saying it was a bit of a pain having to sit there in front of a 14-inch CRT back then.
Not at all. I've got a 14-inch CRT at home next to my 32-inch LCD, and that looks awesome.
Yeah.
And I play stuff through there, and it's multi-sync, and it's awesome, yeah, so... I think that's just because they've probably gone, old tellies, oh, you had to lug them around, but they haven't actually sat down and compared them. They have a different aesthetic, don't they?
Yeah, oh, totally. For old consoles, CRTs, you know, we were talking about last week, I think, or the week before, weren't we? I was actually having a little debate with someone on Facebook on one of the retro groups the other day, and this guy said, well, I haven't got room for a CRT. A lot of people were agreeing with him, like, well, we all made room for them until about 10 years ago, so
yeah,
the house has got smaller.
God, I used to think of the stuff that I used to balance my CRT on. Like, I used to have this huge 19-inch one, and it used to sit on my Amiga, and I could swear I'd seen the case kind of buckle.
A friend of mine had, like, a telescopic arm he put on his desk that supported, like, a 19-inch CRT.
Wow.
That must have been some strength in that arm, yeah. Next on their list is blowing games. Now, obviously, that was the thing that you did with cartridges, even though you were always advised not to, weren't you?
Yeah, yeah. And as soon as I got this Game Boy Advance, I put a Game Boy game in.
Yeah.
Didn't work. Knew straight away, I'm not going to blow on it. I'm going to get some IPA, isopropyl alcohol, and do it properly.
How boring.
Yeah, I know. It's sad. But it works now every time.
That said, I have done it with a Switch before. You just out of instinct, I get a little card and like, blow it before I put it in. I don't know.
I blow on CD-ROMs.
Other things they're talking about in here, I mean, they're talking about snow internet. I mean, obviously. Ball mice as well. Now, this is a bit of an interesting one. I did it the other day. I was playing one of my old systems and the mouse wasn't moving properly. I was like, oh, I've got to clean the ball on it.
Yeah.
That was something that, you know, we completely, something we don't have to do anymore, but it was a bit of a pain.
They were really good to chuck at your mates in the IT room, though. They absolutely caned if you threw a ball mouse at someone.
Well, the actual mouse or just a ball?
The ball. Bang.
We used to do that, actually. We'd nick them out of the mice and like, hide them around the room, yeah. And then, you know, the class couldn't start. Little rebels. But I never used to do it properly, you know, like you said there with the IPA and all that. I'd just get my fingernail and try
scrape the black scud off it.
Yeah. Which is pretty minging. Controller ergonomics. And now they've got a picture of the Mega Drive controller here that I actually think still is very comfortable in the hand.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, because we come from a kind of computery background, yeah. And we had the Amiga, which had up to jump on a lot of things, and that was really frustrating. But now they have a monster joystick where you can actually remap live on the joystick the up to jump, so you can get over that.
I mean, you know, things that I've noticed recently, floppy disks as well. I mean, I just can't be bothered with them anymore. Even on my old systems, it's like the other day I was looking at downloading a game that didn't have like a hard disk installer, and it came on like 6 discs, and I thought, I've got to download all the images, I've got to find 6 blank discs, write them a disk, and I thought, oh, I can't be bothered.
I kind of still love floppies,
yeah.
And I've got a tool called ADF Blaster, and you can just put it in, and it's like burning a CD, you just put it in and then reboot, and yeah, I found a load of floppies from the post office the other day.
Okay.
So I've got like loads of branded
post office
stuff.
Made floppy disks.
Yeah, like all stuff for their tills and counters, actually, which is quite mad.
And the last one on their list, which did actually make me laugh, it goes add-ons. Before the days of the PlayStation and Xbox One, we had the 32X and Mega CD and a multitude of other bizarre and wonky add-ons for consoles. These days, there's no way Nintendo, Sony or Microsoft would ever get away with releasing hardware like that. Thank goodness for that. And then I thought, PSVR?
Yeah, but we've lost multi-taps, haven't we? Remember, yeah. Multi-taps used to be, every system would have a different multi-tap and... Now we just sync the controllers to have more players.
Well, that's actually one thing that is not on their list, but I think, yeah, you know, having cords on controllers, you know, did really limit how close you could get to your system. Though that said, the other day, I was playing on my PSVR, which I don't very often, and first time I played it in my new living room, and it's like quite a big room, and I was sat on the couch and it said out of range. I thought, what am I going to do? So I've had to get a camp chair for gaming in the living room now because the couch is too far away.
I'm going on my VR chair.
Yeah, as if I didn't feel geeky enough with a headset on. So if you want to check the rest of that list and maybe let us know your retro gaming annoyances. Maybe you've got some. It's always nice to hear from you during the week. You can tweet us at Retro Hour UK on Facebook and Instagram as well. Now, let's talk about this Sega Saturn music player. What on earth is this about?
Yeah, this is crazy. So I've just seen these kind of Sega Saturn-themed music player. Now, these music player are these kind of high-res ones. So have you heard of these new,
no.
new high-resolution audio, which is basically, it's like higher than FLAC, I think. It's completely like...
Uncompressed. Like whatever is it, yeah?
Yeah, okay. And there's all these high-end little devices that you're getting at the moment. This is actually called the CT10, and they've rebranded it from Activo to Sega Saturn. So...
And it looks like a little Sega Saturn.
It looks like a little Saturn, and they've even got the disc drive in there and everything. It's $397 at the moment, ooh, so it's quite expensive. But it also comes pre-installed with a few Sega tunes.
Okay.
So it has a Supersonic Racing from Sonic R.
Oh, and, I did like that.
Dreams from Dreams Into Nights.
From Nights Into Dreams, yeah.
Yeah, Nights Into Dreams.
That's cool. I mean, it's released in Japan at the moment, and I can see them in kind of stuff like that. You know, it does work in the Japanese market because they're quite into like kind of wacky, bizarre stuff like that. I'm not sure I'd buy one, if I'm honest, for $397. I don't know who the market is for this. I do think it's cool, though. Well, I do want one.
My friend's got one of these, and he spent about £300-400. Not on this actual model, but he's okay. Got one of these high-res audio players, and there seems to be quite a market for it. You know, people, real audiophiles that are into that kind of stuff. So this time you can combine your two loves, retro gaming and audio.
Well, I was watching a video that Techmoan did about HD CDs. Have you seen that? Like CDs that are really high quality audio. They're released in Japan as well.
Oh.
Yeah, so I mean, there is a market. I mean, it is a limited market, I imagine, like audiophiles who also love the Sega Saturn.
Yeah, yeah. You're limiting it a bit there. Yeah, all your Nintendo fans aren't going to get that one.
But I love the fact that it does actually come in what looked like an original Sega Saturn box as well. Sega are licensing some weird stuff at the moment, aren't they?
Definitely. What was that, Sonic Toaster?
Yeah. Long may it continue. Gives us stuff to talk about every week, doesn't it?
Definitely.
Now, the Atari Lynx is a system I've got a lot of fondness for. And it turns out the Lynx has actually got a pretty decent homebrew scene. And it's probably going to get even better as there is a new flash cart coming out next year. And I've been reading about this new homebrew game for the Lynx called Lakim's Legacy. Now, this is a couple of guys on Atari Age, and they're essentially making a full RPG for the Atari Lynx, and
that
it looks
awesome.
Pretty good. Have you seen the video on their website?
Yeah, it looks really nice. It's just awesome. I love the graphics as well. The kind of quality of the drawing that they've done is quite high for a Lynx game, actually.
Yeah, I mean, there is like a big thread on Atari Age at the moment, and they're saying it is quite early in development. They've got a lot of work to do in it yet. And if you watch the video they've put on YouTube, it has sound effects and music running at the same time.
Okay,
which
wow.
is pretty cool.
Yeah.
But they're saying there might be some problems with like RAM limitations. Apparently they've got a trick where they swap things in and out of RAM from the ROM, so...
It sounds confusing to get it, you know, really running well. But I reckon these guys, you know, that these kind of projects, they'll optimise the hell out of it, and it'll probably one of the best titles on there for RPG.
Yeah, I mean, it did. The sound chip in the Lynx was pretty good, you know, especially considering that came out in 1989. And like, you look at like the original Game Boy and stuff that they can do on the Lynx in comparison, it was worlds apart. And I reckon this game is going to have NPCs in there as well. It's going to have a fully functioning inventory system. There's going to be like, you know, 8 independent animated objects on screen at any one time, projectiles in the game too. And they're essentially waiting for this flash card to come out, I think, before they can release it, because obviously people want to put it on their own systems and play it on the original hardware. But it's an isometric RPG game as well. And I've never been the biggest fan of RPGs in the past, but I think I've got quite into the Lynx recently, so I would like a new game on it. And it does look like it's quite an easy pick-up and play one.
Yeah, I love the isometric graphics. It really looks like... It reminds me of Populous.
Yeah.
You know, it's got that kind of look. But a bit more fun, indie gamey. And a bit more modern.
Well, I went home a couple of weeks ago to see the family. And my little nephew, Harry, is like 5 years old. Whenever I'm there, he goes, Uncle Dan, have you brought it? Have you brought the Nintendo Switch? And I actually had the Lynx in my bag, you know, as well, to show my brother. So he was like, oh, bring it up. I wouldn't mind a play on that. I got it out and he looked at it like, what's this? Right, and you can see the disappointment on his face that it wasn't the Nintendo Switch. When I got like Pat lined up on it, he was like, oh, okay. And he sat there, he was playing on it. He loved it after about 10 minutes. I had to drag it out of him. But it was
awesome.
A new generation loving the Lynx. So before we get into our interview and we talk all about teletext, I mean, we do need to talk about this story. It has been all over. At Games, up to more mischief, it seems. Now, this is a really bizarre story. Have you heard about this? At Games, obviously the company that... They haven't got the best reputation in the world of retro gaming.
All I know about At Games was that they made that Mega Drive, that kind of the sound was messed up on it. It wasn't amazingly good, and now Sega's possibly dropped them to build their own Mega Drive.
That's essentially it. I mean, they brought out a few of these kind of clone cheap consoles. I think they did like an Atari one a while ago as well.
Cheap and tacky, was it? Yeah.
They haven't got, you know, a very good reputation at all. But it turns out recently they've been getting some pretty good reviews on websites and from a few YouTubers as well for this product they've got called the Bandai Namco Flashback.
Okay, so they've teamed up with Bandai Namco. That's, Bandai Namco even.
Well, essentially, it's 8 arcade classics. You've got stuff on there like, Pac-Man was built into it as well. And a couple of YouTubers, including a guy called John Hancock, who... check his channel out if you haven't, he's really good. He did a review of it, and again, he was a bit skeptical, or it's At Games. He reviewed it, and he said, actually, it's a pretty good product.
Yeah.
So it plugs into your TV. It's got a little controller that looks a bit like a Mega Drive controller, actually, with these games built in. Now, as it turns out, after it got these good reviews from a few YouTubers, it got released into a few stores in America. And it turns out, even though the box was exactly the same, and there's no change in description, it was the same artwork on the front of the box and everything, when you got it, it was completely different to the review units they sent out to people. Now, the big difference is the review units had original arcade ROMs on there. So if you want to play, you know, Pac-Man, it was the original arcade version of Pac-Man, the proper version. But the version they've been selling like Walmart in America, they've got NES ROMs instead.
That's really weird as well, because that is odd, because why would they put NES ROMs on? Because Nintendo are the guys who are going to sue you to hell, unless they had a deal with Nintendo where they're like, oh, we've got these NES ROMs anyway, let's distribute them. But then why wouldn't they put the arcade stuff on?
Yeah.
Really odd, that is.
I don't get it. Obviously...
And then they're not... all the screenshots are incorrect then, and the box is accurately not describing what's actually inside it.
They've got that old little disclaimer there on the bottom. Screenshots may differ from actual product on the back of the box, because it is the arcade.
That's an old school... bastard trick.
It was all easy to do on cassette games, wasn't it, back in the day. It's really bizarre, though, because obviously the hardware can run the arcade versions of it.
Yeah, and if there was these reviews, so have these kind of... has there been a comparison with the older units then?
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, after that video came out, John Hancock, he did another video saying, look, okay, ignore my review, don't buy this product, it's different in the shops. And there was like a comparison video as well showing what he showed in his video and like what the release version is. And yeah, they're totally different games. It's like, I just can't get my head around why they do that. And someone actually called them out on Twitter. They tweeted them and actually put like, you know, class action lawsuit incoming. They replied, and the only kind of excuse they give, as it were, was some of the early units had NES ROMs on there, but the later ones will have arcade eventually, but not the ones that are in shops at the moment. It seems really weird.
It does seem really weird. I think they're a company after a fast buck, and this probably proves it. But, you know, they're going to make it anyway. They're going to keep pumping out these systems, and mums across and dads are going to buy them thinking this is what my son had, and then the kids are going to be disappointed, you know.
Well, I think, like we've said before, they're aimed at casuals, essentially, aren't they? They're like, you know, the person who might not have played Pac-Man for, like, 30 years and they're spotted in, like, a supermarket.
That's exactly it. And, yeah, and I'm glad Sega's kind of dropped them now if they're messing about doing this.
That's a rumour, isn't it, that Sega are going to bring their Mega Drive Mini in-house. That's why it's been delayed. I love this comment, though, on the article in Nintendo Life. Top comment on there. At Games is like the opposite of the Nintendo seal of quality. Something looks great, and then you see the At Games logo and walk away. So, yeah. If you say, I mean, generally, I would never buy any of their products. I don't understand why they keep doing it, though. It's just baffling.
Fastbook. That's what I think it is.
So we'll keep you updated on that story if we hear any more. And, of course, you can read that and everything else we've talked about on this week's show on our website, theretrohour.com. We did have a little issue with iTunes last week that we hope is sorted out now.
Yeah, basically, iTunes stopped pumping out to a few people.
Yeah.
So check your iTunes and refresh and see if you can actually download us this week. So if you can't, then we're available on Audio Boom, but this issue should be resolved.
Yeah, I mean, well, if you're listening to this, I get it is. Yes, it is. That's your way to the end.
That's it. Yeah.
But if you ever do have any more problems, do let us know, because we do get a few people getting in touch on Twitter. Turns out it was at Apple's end, not ours. So, obviously, if you do spot anything like that, let us know. We'll get straight on it. But you can get the show every week on our website at theretrohour.com. Right then. Let's get our teletext on. This week's special guest, the teletext archaeologist, Jason Robertson. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it's time to welcome on this week's very special guest. A topic that we, even though we've both really been into this all of our lives and has got so much nostalgia, something we really haven't covered enough on this podcast. This week's guest is Jason Robertson, and we're going to be talking about Teletext. So welcome to the show, Jason.
Hello. Hi, Dan. Hi, Roy. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. Now, before we get into kind of, you know, what's happening with Teletext today, because there is still quite an active scene around it. I mean, I remember being a kid and my dad coming home with, like, our first Teletext TV and being blown away that you could get this kind of on-demand stuff at the time. I mean, what was your kind of, like, earliest memory of Teletext? Did you have kind of a moment when you were blown away by it as a kid?
Yeah, it's much the same, really, isn't it? I mean, at the time when I discovered Teletext, it must have been about 1980, 81, that sort of time, we went over to a relative's house and they had a Teletext set, and they basically sat me down, handed me the remote control and said, you know, play with this. And it was amazing that that, because television in those days was very much you watched what was on and you had no control over what, because there was no video recorders in wide circulation at that time, so you watched what was on and you had to put up with it. But handed this Teletext controller, you could choose your own image that was on the screen at that time, and you could see what was going to be on the television without a Radio Times. You could see what the news was going to be, what the weather was going to be, whenever you wanted to see it. It wasn't when the TV news came on or the weather came on. It was when you wanted to see it, which is just remarkable for the time.
I think, you know, it kind of had that excitement that the web or the internet had when I first got on it, actually, for me.
Yes, exactly. It's exactly the same thing, really, isn't it? I mean, they're similar in more ways than you imagine, because, you know, the internet data travels via packets, as does Teletext data. Is exactly the same thing. So it's they share, you know, in more ways than one, they do share a sort of a common heritage, if you like.
I think a lot of people remember Teletext because they had different experiences with it. I know that playing and watching live football on Teletext was a whole thing, and there was the Teletext holidays and stuff. What uses did they have for it then?
Oh, apart from the football and Teletext, well, as I say, I mean, it's on-demand news and on-demand weather. A bit later on, of course, there was the quizzes that was on. I mean, they used to have quizzes from the start on Teletext, but they were very much a case of here's a question, press reveal to find out what the answer is. So you could press reveal and up would pop the answer. Or we could have jokes as well, had reveals on. But a bit later on, many people remember Bamboozle, where you had the fast text buttons at the bottom of the screen. You had the red, the yellow, the blue and the green options that you could press. And the quiz ran that way, and you had to choose the right answer. So yeah, there's many, many uses for Teletext. I mean, not only is there the Teletext that you could see, but there's also hidden things within Teletext as well. There is data transmission that went on. There was a service called Televox that ran in the late 80s, and that basically, you rang up a premium telephone line and you had your own Teletext service then. You had to speak page numbers down the phone to the server, and it would send you the pages that you requested. And they were sort of like, you know, higher premium pages of information. There was that as well. The BBC used it. They had an internal system called Telfax, which was often leaked out onto the normal Teletext signal as well. So we've got a couple of examples of that in the archive. So there's not outside of the usual information, there's all sorts of really interesting stuff hidden within Teletext, you know, if you go digging for it.
So was that BBC thing like an intranet kind of thing, essentially, then?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. Yeah, it had descriptions of programs, and it had an internal telephone directory. You know, that sort of thing that you would see on an internet, sort of the sort of corporate stuff. I don't think it's terribly interesting to the outside viewer, but, you know, anything that's sort of hidden is automatically interesting, isn't it, by its very nature? So, that's very interesting. I'm still working on extracting all that, so it's a bit noisy at the moment, but that's a work in progress, and there's definitely some data there to get out.
Well, we'll get more into how you actually extract, you know, these pages all these years later in just a bit. But, I mean, I remember being a kid at school and we had, like, BBC microcomputers. And one day, I think it was, like, Mode 7 on the BBC Micro was like teletext mode. And when I got into that and like there was a programme where we could make teletext pages, and I was like, whoa, hang on, this is that thing I use on TV at home. I mean, how were teletext pages actually made then? What was it with the BBC Micro?
Well, in the early days, no, they had, I believe they put the data, the pages of data onto the main computer using punch tape in the very, very early days. Mm. So it went on that way. They had dedicated sort of terminals. Like in the early days of computing, we used to have mainframes, and we had terminals that connected to the mainframe, so that the terminal didn't have any computing power of its own. It connected to the mainframe, and I believe they had that sort of setup in the early days of teletext too. So not necessarily BBC Micros, although you could create the pages, you know, just as well on the BBC Micro with it having the Mode 7 functionality. Not to be confused with Mode 7 on the SNES.
Yeah. Unfortunate coincidence, though, that name.
Yeah. A bit of a different thing.
Well, we've had Mr. Biffo of Digitizer fame on, and he was a very risque character, and I guess he was kind of running teletext at one point by himself, wasn't he?
Well, he'd like you to think that, I'm sure. But, it was a very popular part of the Teletext service, the Teletext Limited service. Anyway, and that, you know, that ran from what, for about 10 years, I think, Digitizer. But it's one of the things with recovering Teletext is that Teletext, it was transient in nature. It was shown one day and it had gone the next day. All the information that was on the service that you watched yesterday was no longer there. You can't, you know, there's no archive for you to read old pages on. It's here one day, gone the next. So pages like Digitizer, which are very sort of, you know, culturally important, just disappear, and they've gone and they're lost forever, you know, until now when we can recover them.
I mean, for people who might be listening outside the UK, I mean, Digitizer, we did a show on it before, like Ravi said, but it was essentially like a daily video games magazine that you would read on your television by teletext. But they used to put out some pretty risque stuff as well. I mean, was the legislature at the time, were they kind of paying attention to that, or could you kind of slip under the radar?
I think it definitely slipped under the radar there. I think you had to know what you were reading. I think it's very much like on children's shows. Sometimes you'll see they'll do jokes that adults will understand, but the children will just go straight over the heads. It's that sort of thing, I think, the humour of Digitizer.
Well, you mentioned Bamboozled there earlier, and that was a kind of teletext quiz. Well, do you know of any other teletext games?
There was, they did do a similar one that was sport-based. I think it was 10 to 1, I think that was called. But that would use exactly the same sort of technology in there. But I think that, I mean, Bamboozle was a fantastic use of the technology, because it was very interactive, so it was no longer press reveal of the answer. It was, you know, multiple choice. It was, I thought it was a brilliant use of the technology that somebody invented there.
Yeah, because, I mean, if anyone ever used that, it was essentially you'd see a character on the screen, you get a question, you'd have to say it in your mind and then press a button and see if you got it right, wouldn't you, essentially?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I mean, you could work out, if you could press all the colour buttons sometimes and work out which was the page number that was different from the others, and that would be the right answer. So you could sort of cheat as well at Bamboozle.
Well, sadly, in 2012, CFAX closed, and this was kind of one of our main teletext services. I think it was the last one in the UK. Was this like a launching point for many new teletext projects or archiving?
I think it's very much a coincidence, I think. It's a happy coincidence. But I think I started to use my TV capture card to archive pages from about 2010 onwards, because I knew it was going to be closing, so I thought, I'd better save some services for, you know, the benefit of the future, because all we had at that point was whatever people had managed to save off their PT capture cards, which wasn't very much, particularly from earlier in the 80s. So I think I started archiving in 2010. But in 2012, Alistair Buxton invented a way of recovering teletext from videotape, which frankly I was astounded by. I thought, this is the most remarkable thing I've ever seen, because, you know, I mean, we've all tried it, I guess. We've put a videotape into the player. We've pressed a text button, hoping to see teletext come up, but nothing really happens. If you're lucky, you might get a mangled page, but that's the best you can get, unless you had SVHS, which was pretty good. But the being able to recover it from videotape was a remarkable thing to happen. And that came out about 2012, at about the same time CFAX finished. With that happening and the increase in computer power, I think teletext sort of moved from being a BBC controlled thing, but then being controlled by the TV companies, because the TV companies have closed all their teletext services. It moved then from being an enthusiast driven thing, at least in the UK, where there was no more television services. So in the UK, I mean, the enthusiasts sort of took it over and democratized teletext.
So that blew my mind when I read about that, because, I mean, I always kind of assumed that teletext was kind of, you know, encoded in the television picture. That's why your television could look at it. But the fact that you could actually put a videotape in that you recorded like 30 years ago and still extract that information, I mean, it's obviously still in there, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, well, it is part of the TV picture. I mean, you're right. The teletext data itself is stored at the very, very top of the TV picture, but televisions are set up to sort of crop the video picture that you're interested in to crop that bit out, and, you know, chop the teletext data off at the top, which goes off into some separate circuitry in your television to be decoded later.
Well, you mentioned that you kind of take it from VHS and Betamax as well. I was wondering how many Betamax ones you actually get, because that wasn't a very popular format in the UK, but I guess you've had to get players for them all as well.
Yeah, I mean, VHS players are quite easy to come by. Betamax are, you know, a bit more expensive, but there's still plenty of them around. There are older recording formats as well. They're most notably the Philips N1500 and N1700 VCRs. And I've got an N1700, but it doesn't work at the moment. I think it needs new belts, so I need to get my screwdriver out at some point and go have a look. But yeah, it is amazing what you can get out from these old video formats.
Yes, I mean, there's definitely, I remember like VT2000, wasn't that like a dual-sided video format that was around in the early 80s too? There's so many weird little formats that came and went.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, VT2000, I've picked up a few V2000 tapes from somewhere. We don't have a player, but I'm sure the teletext can be just as easily retrieved from there too. I mean, it may work even better than Beta or VHS, for all I know.
So what's been the most interesting thing, or a few interesting things that you've discovered in the archiving process so far then?
Well, I think what interests me, I think, is that the very, very early days of teletext, because it was very much a sort of a friendlier sort of atmosphere about it, because there wasn't very many people who had teletext decoders at that time, because they were very, very expensive. So the sort of journalism was a bit more sort of one-to-one, a bit friendlier, if you like, outside of the news and whatnot. But they'd have letter pages asking people to write in with ideas of what they could do with certain things. I'm really interested to see how those sort of pages from the earlier days, there's also, you can see how the service evolved over time as well. I mean, it was developed by the BBC and IBA in the early 70s, and they'd got similar sort of systems, but they weren't compatible. So they joined forces in 1976, and teletext, as we know it, was born, and that's how it's been ever since. But I'd like to be able to see some really old teletext pages from before 1976, when the standards were different, just to see what they look like.
You're getting into the territory of really old videos there. So do you have to do a lot of, like, cleaning up or re-putting the tape in there to extract it?
Yeah, I mean, every recovery I do requires some kind of cleaning up, usually. There's always the odd letter that's wrong and the odd graphics character that's wrong, but they can be cleaned up. But certainly my earliest recovery so far is from, I think, March 1976 or thereabouts, and that came from a dub from the original tape, so it was a copy of a copy, if you like, and it's so noisy and messy. It's very difficult to get anything, you know, usable out of it at all. But, you know, it is there. I've cleaned what I can up. And there are visible pages I've come out from a tape that's, what, 40 years old.
Now, most people didn't even have videos then, though, did they? It's like...
No, I mean, exactly. I mean, and teletext wasn't even broadcast all the time. Like, on the examples that I had on the tape, the teletext was only on sometimes. I mean, I don't know when, I don't know why, I don't know why that would be. I think it was if the TV station had opted out from the national feed, perhaps, to run their own local programming, then they just didn't have teletext on because the technology wasn't there to bridge the data between the regions. But it wasn't even on all the time, teletext at the time.
Well, you mentioned Telfax and these kind of hidden services. Did you end up like finding them and kind of have you read any of the stuff on them?
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh, yeah. It's a nosy person's paradise, really, just seeing what's in there. So, for example, I mean, we've touched on Telfax already, which is the sort of BBC intranet, if you like, of teletext services. But there's also the one I'm currently doing, the recovery I'm currently doing, has got data packets in it. Now, these, if you imagine the teletext page has 25 rows on it, the teletext specification itself allows up to 32. So the 7 rows that you can't see on a television picture. And what they do with them is they put data in those rows. So you can't see them on screen, but the decoder can do stuff with them. And in one of these data rows, the one the recovery I'm currently doing, there is racing data. So there's odds for horse races in there. So presumably it was a data service that was paid for by somebody to distribute racing odds around the country. Oh, okay. So that's an interesting one. They've got Telfax, we've already mentioned. The late 90s, they had on Sky, we had Sky Interactive in the late 90s. And what you could do there is you could call up a number again, a bit like Televox I mentioned earlier. You'd ring up a premium number or just a number, and it would give you a teletext page that was yours. So you'd enter the teletext page on your remote control, and then it would ask you to type in your account number for your bank. So you type in your account, you type in a PIN number, and you'd be able to access your account details on teletext.
Wow.
Which is, and those have been recovered. They are actually, they're still on the teletext, on the on videotape, of course. And modern technology being as it is, I can, on that recovery, I can look at any page at any time, and you can see people checking their account balances online. You can't, it only tells you how much they've got in the bank. It doesn't tell you what they've spent the money on, unfortunately.
No SSL encryption on that, though, I bet.
No. Well, this that you see, none of it is personally identifiable, so you could argue that that's secure.
Crazy the stuff that's hidden in there. I mean, Ravi and I were chatting before we started recording. I mean, he'd been reading about kind of Easter eggs that were in there. For example, like, you know, some of the editors might leave personal messages there to the friends or the wife or something. Did you come across?
Yeah, that's right. Apparently, I mean, this is one of the holy grails that which I'd like to find. But the story goes, the first editor of CFAX, Colin McIntyre, used to send his wife messages on the teletext service to tell him when he was going to be home for his dinner. So, to find one of those, that'd be something. That'd be something else to find something like that.
So, how did he do that?
I don't know. I mean, I guess there are ways of hiding information in teletext. Like I've talked about the data lines 25 to 31, just for hiding data on there. But there's that. Bamboozle itself, the quiz was used hidden pages to a degree because. Although your pages are always like 100, 101, 102, all the way up to 199, for example, in that range, the teletext service itself wasn't decimal, it was hexadecimal. So you could have pages like 1AF, for example. And that's how Bamboozle worked. The Bamboozle pages were sort of hidden as hexadecimal page numbers so that you couldn't enter with your remote control, but you could get to using the fast text controls. So that's one way of hiding something. Or I think probably what Colin McIntyre did, I would imagine, is he would have created a page that just wasn't mentioned anywhere within the CFAX itself. So, of course, you've got your index on page 100. 101 is the news headlines. 199 is the index, for example. Maybe he put the page at something like 169 or something that wasn't being used. Then he put his wife knew that number, typed the number in, and she'd be able to see the page.
I'll be home late tonight, dear.
That's right. Because your dinner's in the dog.
So, I've seen that you've kind of been attending teletext festivals, and this seems like a awesome thing for me. Like, tell us all about the scene.
Yeah, you make it sound like some sort of festival. We all camp over for the weekend there.
Watch pages
on a giant screen. Yeah.
That would be great, but it's only partially like that. I mean, that's the beers come afterwards. But I mean, there's as we were saying earlier on, the teletext got democratized to a degree after it closed in this country, and there's a few of us. You got in touch via Twitter, and we all meet up once a year generally, and we set up somewhere. We've visited the Centre for Computing History in Cambridge. We've had a room there, and we set up and we've done our thing in there, which is doing whatever we do. So there's me out doing the recovery of services. There's artists as well. There's other techies doing great things with the hardware and great things with the software and the enhanced level teletext and whatnot. So we all get together in one room. It's a really good way of there are very few examples of artists and technical people working together as closely as that, I think. So it's a really good example of art and science, if you like, mixed up to achieve a common goal. But so we set up in a room and we all do our thing, and the general public can come in, chat to us. We have an art competition, and we have lots of stuff being demoed. We have hardware demonstrations, so we have Raspberry Pi setups that mean that you can have teletext on your own television right now, even though it's closed. You can use a Raspberry Pi to view teletext again at home. There's that. There are teletext demos using the BBC Micro Mode 7 that we talked about earlier on. So we've had those in the past, which have been absolutely fantastic. So it's everything you can imagine, really, from a sort of a retro computer gaming party, if you like. But instead, it's teletext related.
Well, what amazes me is, as you mentioned, there's teletext demos, and I've seen one of them myself, and it looks absolutely insane. It was that Bad Apple demo, but they did it all in teletext. It was running on a BBC Master. Absolutely amazing. All these software and kind of new tools are coming out at the moment. Which ones are your favourite? Oh, that's a hard question.
That's a good question. I would say the higher level enhanced teletext stuff is most interesting at the moment, because what that's about is that we're all used to teletext as we saw it at home in the 80s and 90s, but there was an enhanced specification which allowed for a lot more colours and a lot more graphical shapes, a bit like Petsky on the Commodore machines, where you've got hearts and circles and diagonal lines. It's a bit like that, but for teletext. So you could have what looked like high resolution graphics, but was actually just using characters to generate it. So it's a bit like Petsky. There's that, and more colours, as I say. You could redefine the character set as well. So you could just had almost like sprites, if you like, almost on there. And that's Alistair Cree is one of our colleagues in the teletext collective, if you like, has developed some software that will actually allow you to do that on a teletext page and create enhanced level teletext data, which is it's a fantastic thing to play with. So we didn't really run with enhanced teletext in this country, but now teletext is finished, we can start to play with it as enthusiasts and see what we can do with it.
I mean, are there teletext tools available for, like, vintage computers too?
Yes, there's. There are teletext editors for the BBC Micro, as you mentioned earlier, because you know obviously the BBC Micro had a teletext chip built in. But as far as other microcomputers are concerned, then the Spectrum had a teletext adapter, as did the Amstrad, and the Commodore 64 had one, probably others as well. I mean, the Oric had teletext compatibility built in. But I don't know if you ever had a teletext adapter for it. So there's that, certainly, for older computers.
Well, you mentioned the Raspberry Pi there as well. I was looking at this thing called Raspberry Pi Teletext, which was a kind of system where you could hook up the Raspberry Pi via the analog and then press text and, as you said, go straight onto teletext. Is that an archived version of teletext or a live running one?
It could be either. I mean, the recoveries that I generate, I run them through Raspberry Teletext to view them on a normal domestic television. Because part of the work that I'm doing is I've written an emulator for Teletext, so the recoveries that come out of the process, I can run them on my Windows machine and view them as if it was on a television. So, I mean, that's something I'm working on, but to make sure I'm doing I'm interpreting things correctly, I can use Raspberry Teletext to put that same recovery on a proper Teletext set to make sure that what I'm generating looks like actual proper Teletext. And also, you know, for any, you can just take it into your living room and browse a Teletext series at leisure.
So how does this work then? So using a Raspberry Pi, I guess you use the composite output into a television. I mean, and then you can press the text button on your remote. How does this work?
Yeah, I mean that's right. I mean the Teletext data itself sits at the top of the TV picture, but the TV picture's cropped out in normal use, so you can't see these swirling lines of bits that are at the top of the TV screen. Now, those what the Raspberry Teletext does is it draws these dots and bits and data onto the top of the TV screen that you can see on the Raspberry Pi. But then it uses a sort of a clever hardware trick to shift the entire page up so that those swirling Teletext bits that you could see a minute ago are now off screen. But they're off screen to you, but they appear in the range of what the Teletext decoder on the television set can see. And then the television decoder on the television set picks that up as an actual Teletext signal and decodes it. And that's been put to great use, not only for viewing recoveries, but also for what's called a TFAX, which is sort of an enthusiast-generated Teletext service. And that's updated by anybody, really, by enthusiasts who've got access to it, and you can update pages on there. It has RSS feeds of news, so it's got a complete news service on there, just like the CFAX used to have. There's art on there as well, and it all gets updated automatically, and when people update, upload new art to it. So it's well worth trying TFAX out, actually, as a project, just to get old school Teletext back on your TV set.
Yeah, because I really want to have a monitor in my office and just have TFAX going straight into there. Because I saw it the other day and the guy had BBC News and it was all the latest headlines on it. There was even a Mr. Biffo section. There was it's like a community Teletext. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, Biffo's got a big section on there with lots of art in. And he's done some special pages for TFAX as well. So it's well worth seeking out if you're a fan of Mr. Biffo.
How do you get access to this then? What do you need?
It's just a Pi, isn't it? And Python.
Well, you know, well, yeah, the Python comes with the OS anyway, but there is a website which I'll pass you the link later on, and maybe put it in the show notes if you have them. But there's a website that you can go to, and it'll install it for you on your Raspberry Pi. You just run this script and it'll install everything you need, and just press, I think you just type go, and off it does its things. It loads Raspberry Teletext. It shifts the screen up for you. So all you have to do is just press text on your remote control and away you go.
I know what I'm doing. I've got about four Raspberry Pis doing nothing in drawers at home. So I need to play Bamboozle again or something like that. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, definitely worth a go. I mean, Bamboozle, there is actually a quiz on TFAX, but I think it's a techie quiz at the moment about Teletext technology. It's definitely worth giving it a go. And the recoveries that I've done as well, they also have playable Bamboozles in them. So on the Twitter, I always share those. So people can go and have a go of old Bamboozles right now in the web browser. But instead of pressing the red, green, yellow, and blue buttons, you just click the link on the Teletext page instead. But it's exactly the same experience.
I remember kind of the last big like hurrah for Teletext was probably September 11th, 2001, when it was kind of the early days of the web still, really. A lot of people were still on dial-up, and a lot of the news websites crashed. But Teletext stayed online, didn't it? And that was kind of the last like big day that everyone went to Teletext for news that you can remember?
Yeah, I guess it was, yeah. I mean, the difference with Teletext there is that with it being broadcast, you don't swamp a server with requests for data. It's just been pumped out anyway. So, yeah, it's kind of very sad when it closed, because I think, as well as being useful for that sort of occasion when servers go down on the internet, it's a technology that's very, very easy to use, and everybody knows how to work Teletext. And it's, in some respects, it's quicker than the internet. I mean, if you know the page number, you can press text and have the page number typed in to get the football scores before you can get there using a smartphone.
I mean, do you think it's still got a place in the modern world? I mean,
it's difficult to say, isn't it? I mean, it's still in use in a number of countries around the world, particularly in Germany. It's still used there. So if you ever go abroad, have a nose around on the foreign TV stations, press text, and a lot of the time they've got a Teletext service still running on them. It's still in use, certainly, around Europe today, and there's no sign of it being turned off. They get switched off occasionally, you get the occasional one switched off, but, millions of people still use it.
I've also noticed there's been a lot of Teletext art around, especially with Digitizer, the show, kind of coming out. They've been doing Teletext icons and stuff. Do you think there's a place for that kind of style of art to continue?
Well, I mean, the good thing about Teletext as a medium is that it has restrictions on it, so you can't do anything that you want to do on Teletext art. You have to work with the restrictions, and if you're really good on the medium, like Horsenberger is, for example, then you can do some incredible artwork with such a limited technology. It's amazing what Steve does with that medium, because it takes up so little space. It's it was 1K to generate all those graphics and characters. It's nothing these days, 1K.
I often find, even though modern TVs have got they're all smart TVs now, they've got web browsers and all that, I can never be bothered opening the web browser on my TV and doing stuff on there. It's like it's still too much hassle, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. You're right. I mean, I think what they did when Teletext closed was we have the red button now, and we still have the red button. I mean, people might not even be aware that we still have it, but the red button text service is a bit like CFAX, but it's not as fast. It's not there immediately when you're turning on. You always press the red button, and it's please wait. You can still dial in page numbers for news items, and the page numbers are still the same as they always were on the red button. So it's still 101 for the news headlines. It's still 154 for science and technology. So it's so CFAX still lives on, I suppose, as a ghost in this red button service that people probably don't even know they have.
But it is quite interesting that technically it is still possible to do Teletext on digital TV, then, it seems.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it was a decision by the broadcasters just not to support it. They just thought, well, it's an excuse to retire it and move on to, what they call digital teletext with the red button. But as I say, it's not fast enough or immediate enough to capture the imagination of the public, I think.
Yeah, it's kind of not standardised as well, so everything's different and all the apps are custom-built ones and stuff. I remember years ago they were trying to do this interactive TV thing. I think it was just before the red button, where you had like multiple choice of different colours and you could play like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and that never really worked.
No. I think I always found those things a little bit too clunky and slow. I think that's the thing with them. I described them as they're just a bit too slow to use, really.
How does this work then? If people want to like get in touch with you, I mean, if I've got like a box of old episodes of like Super Grand recorded on Betamax, can I send them to you and you would extract the information? I mean, do you accept donations?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've got a massive stack of tapes, so you wouldn't believe how many tapes I've got to go through. I think it'll keep me going until I retire, but you know. If people have any tapes that are going to contain things that are of culturally importance, so for example, Channel 4 in the 90s to get digitizer, or really really early recordings, even if they're dubs, you can get some information out of a dub, even though it's not the best quality in the world, you can still get something out of it. So yeah, things like that. I mean, it's certainly to get in touch. I can certainly donate old tapes, and I will get off them what I can. And I always credit the person with when I share the what I've got off the tapes. I always credit the person who donated the tapes.
Is it possible to extract it off like recordings on YouTube and that kind of thing? Or
no, sadly not. Sadly not, because the teletext data is cropped by the encoding process when you record a TV program using your capture card on your PC, it crops the teletext data out.
Damn you, YouTube, and your compression.
I know. Sometimes you'll see an old recording and the screen will flicker and it'll roll up, and you can see the teletext data rolling past as it goes up to the top of the screen. It's like, oh, there it is. Could probably get a page out of that.
I regret throwing away so many old videos now.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's funny. It's like, who'd have thought that, you go through all your old videotapes, you transfer them to DVD, and then you think, right, well, I don't need these anymore now, and you chuck them out. And who'd have thought you could squeeze one last more thing out of these videotapes?
That hidden review of Rise of the Robots from Mr. Biffo that everyone's forgotten about.
Yeah. It's funny about digitizer, actually, because, I used to re-digitize for every day, but I never owned a console. I mean, I had an Amiga.
Ooh.
So, I know. But I never routined it. You know, I was never that sort of an Amiga owner. But that's the thing with digitizer, is that even if you didn't have a console, it was still entertaining, because the surreal humor, that really made it an interesting read.
And I also found Channel 4, it was like, was that Oracle that Channel 4 had? It all seemed a bit more laid back than the BBC service in many ways.
Yeah, I think so. It changed over time. I mean, as I say, with CFAX, in the very early years, it was quite sort of laid back, but then it got more sort of professional as it went on. And then in late 1989, CFAX... I'm not really entirely sure what happened to it, but I think it got transferred into BBC News, and it became instantly more newsy, and there was no fun in it at all. You know, all the fun and games had disappeared. All the general sort of interest things had just gone, and they'd just been replaced with news and weather and travel. It was very newsy, so it had this sort of the dark ages, the CFAX dark ages period there from of late 1989 to, it was the second half of the 90s. But then in the second half of the 90s, they brought all the general content back. And so it was a lot less stuffy than it used to be. I think Oracle was always generally the same sort of level. I mean, the teletext was the same sort of thing, I think. I think maybe teletext was slightly more removed from Oracle on the ITV service. It's difficult to say.
Well, Jason, I think it's a wonderful thing that you're doing, archiving this kind of, you know, forgotten part of history for many people, but something that we've all got memories of sitting there, you know, with our finger poised over the reveal button or the whole button on Teletext, soaking up all this information. So if people do want to relive it, I mean, where can they find the archive and how do they access it?
I'm on Twitter, and their handle there is @grim_fandango. There's also a website at teletextarchaeologist.org. And there's also a Teletext Facebook group as well. So you can join us on there for sort of a more of a community discussion. And there's also a Teletext Archaeologist page on Facebook as well. So there's any number of ways of getting in touch.
Well, I'll put all those in the show notes as well. This chat brought back some real memories, Jason. So thanks so much for coming up.
No, thanks very much for having me. It's been fantastic.